I never had confidence. I was the shyest, meekest, most introverted, undemonstrative person you could ever meet in your life. I was debilitating. I couldn't put myself forward. I couldn't offer up opinions. I couldn't even contemplate complaining if something wasn't to my liking. Not even a hotel room. I was a salesman. I used to traipse around, going from town to town, trying very badly to sell substandard goods to people who didn't want or even need them in the first place. I barely scraped a living together, and the money that I did make I felt guilty for taking. It was no way to live. I was an inadequate man, living a life he didn't enjoy, his soul shriveling away to nothing, until it came to the final day when his body would shrivel up too. I would have vanished, blown away with nothing to show for it. A life that promised so much when it began. We, the Remedials, by John Travis. It said that life is a journey. Mine was literal. A journey that found me hoping that the inhabitants of the next town would be more gullible than the last. A journey from hotel to hotel, each one a little shabbier as my money dwindled. On arriving in the capital, I'd imagined I'd be stuck in a hostel or something. The prices down there are so ludicrously expensive, I doubted I could have afforded even a half-decent hotel. Outside, everything was grey and wet. People bent heads, staring at the pavements, their feet kicking at the rubbish. Yet they were careful to avoid the wild eyes that stared from moth-eaten sleeping bags, empty polystyrene cups at their sides. In a strange way, I fitted in. I must have wandered for the best part of half an hour through dingy back streets, past grimy-looking cafes and dimly lit newsagents, skirting the odd entrance to a tube station along the way. By now, I was absolutely soaked and wanted nothing more than a place to put my suitcase down and have a rest. It seemed an unlikely place for an art gallery, but when I looked up from my watch, there it was. I knew next to nothing about art, but as there didn't seem to be an admission fee, I went inside. It was a large, airy room with perfect white walls and a high ceiling, and I immediately saw my mistake. Despite being in such a run-down area, the patrons of this gallery were all well-to-do, successful, confident people. And when they saw little old bedraggled me standing there with my suitcase tucked under my arm, well, they did what came naturally. You know that expression, so-and-so made me feel this big? Well, this bunch of unadulterated so-and-sos did exactly that. They had a field day. In the centre of the room were a series of brown wooden benches. With all eyes on me, I headed towards them, shoes squelching, my every step resounding round the room like flatulence in a church. The high ceiling seemed to get higher, the benches farther away. When I eventually arrived at the nearest seat, I laid my case on the end of it and plucked my sopping shirt from my chest so its creases hung against my jacket instead. Sitting down beside my case, I removed a soaking handkerchief from my pocket and wiped my face with it. When I looked up, they were still watching me. A more confident person would have said something at that point, like, "What are you staring at?" Maybe that was why they looked away, en masse, back at the paintings. For a minute or so, I tried to compose myself, determined that I would look at the pictures instead of running away with my tail between my legs. So, taking a deep breath, I got up off the bench. Unfortunately for me, my case decided to do the same thing. I tripped over it, my outstretched hands hitting the floor a split second after my nose did. Horrible, sickly pain spread across my face, and my head filled with an unwelcome noise. As it began to clear, I stood up, leaving a set of comical handprints on the floor. Another noise intruded, the sound of perhaps a dozen people laughing at me. Dusting myself down, I stepped over the case and headed for the nearest wall, still dumbly determined to look at the exhibits. The first canvas was evidently the result of a 5-year-old going mad with a paint box. Completely bewildered by Psychedelic Rampage by Two Chimps, number 4, Jungle, I walked along to the next painting. To my eye, I was looking at more or less the same canvas I'd just passed, when one of the patrons walked towards me. I could sense the others watching. I knew what was coming.
"You come here often?"
a short man with a red face said. Behind him, the room seemed to crawl with sniggers. "Not really," I said.
"Well, do you approve of vomiting without tonsils? If I may be so bold."
"Pardon me?" I followed his gaze to the title. "Oh, right, the name of this..."
"You don't approve,"
the man said. "No, it's just it... well, it's a bit eyebrow filmy, I'm afraid."
"A bit eyebrow, did you say?"
Stifled laughter around the gallery. "No, I said highbrow. Trying to twist my words."
"Well, if it's eyebrow you like, follow me, my good man."
He shepherded me over to the other side of the gallery, pointing at a painting in front of us.
"There,"
he said, winking back at his audience.
"What do you think of that?"
It was a painting of a man in a suit. Perfect, except for the fact that its eyes weren't where they were supposed to be. One was on his knee, while the other was at the end of his big toe. The space below the brows was empty. The laughter at my back bubbled up like noxious fluids in a steaming hot cauldron, scalding my flesh red. I wanted the world to swallow me up. I went back for my case, tucked it under my arm, and I left the gallery with the laughter still echoing. It was raining heavier than ever now, and the streets were empty. I didn't relish the prospect of trying to find lodgings, but turning a corner away from the gallery, my luck seemed to change. Next to what looked like an abandoned tube station was a square, grey, flat-roofed building with the letters REME stenciled above the windows. Wiping my face, I crossed the road and headed for the door. "Good afternoon, Remedial. Can I help you?" a man who looked too cheerful for his own good said to me, without punctuation. It took me a second or two to realise it wasn't meant as an insult. "I'm sorry, I thought this was a hotel. Sorry to have wasted your..." "Yes, this is a hotel, sir. How many nights would you like?" "You're called..." "We are the Remedials." "Yes, sir. At your service. How many nights?" I was a bit flustered, not having thought that far ahead. "Well, I'm not sure. I'm a salesman, you see, and..." "We'll leave that blank for the time being then, shall we?" the man grinned. Suddenly he began to look me up and down, even going so far as to lean over the desk. Then he began nodding, mumbled a few uh-huhs, before saying, "I've just the room for you, sir. Top floor. Excuse me a second." When he turned his face, I saw what looked like a long hose pipe coming through the ceiling. Taking one end in his hand, he started speaking into it. 127, straight away," he said. Putting the hose to his ear, he listened for a few seconds and then nodded. He put it down, then turned back to me. 127 will be made ready by the time we get up there," he said, coming around the reception desk. "We don't have any lifts, so if you'll follow me..." I hope I'm not putting you to any trouble," I said, as we marched upstairs. "No trouble," he informed me, puffing and panting like an old horse fit for the knacker's yard. Going up seemingly endless flights of stairs, It hadn't looked this big from the outside. I saw that this was, without doubt, the most dilapidated hotel I'd ever set foot in. I passed at least three walls with running water, the paper peeling so low that it acted as a second carpet. In one or two places, it was the carpet, I swear. The ceilings were discoloured to the point that it looked like someone had painted them with wet earth. "Here we are," the man said, standing before a door that failed to reach the floor by a couple of inches. "Room 127. I'm sure you'll have a happy stay with us. Here's your key. Goodbye." And with that, he was off, trotting back down the stairs as though expecting a sudden influx of trade to walk in through the mouldy doors. Standing outside the peeling door of room 127 for a second, I wondered why the odd man had handed me a baton. But then, at the end of the long metal pole, I saw the smallest key I had ever seen in my life, barely a quarter of an inch long. Without much hope, I pinched the tiny key between my thumb and forefinger and turned it in the lock, opening the door into the most depressing room I'd ever seen. The first thing to hit me was the smell, an incredibly oppressive odour of staleness, the dust hovering throughout the room. Stepping across the threshold almost felt like I was walking through the screen of a badly tuned television set. Inside, the walls were done in grey wallpaper. What remained of the carpet had once been burgundy. Now it was mostly a series of dubious stains and muddy footprints. The single bed was covered with a faded woolen blanket, full of horrid knotted tassels dangling off the edges to the floor like strands of greasy hair. The bed itself was unusually low to the ground, its shortened legs perhaps only 3 or 4 inches from the floor to the mattress. Despite the dryness of the air, the far wall looked as damp as some of those I'd passed on the way up. And the receptionist said they were getting this room ready. Closing the door behind me, the latch clanked like a prison cell. As I gazed around the rest of the room, something small and brown with multiple legs scuttled away under the door's large gap. Putting my case down on the bed and ignoring the small cloud of dust that flew up around it, I saw that the room also contained a cracked wall-length mirror, a badly varnished wardrobe, a white wicker chair that looked like it would collapse if I sneezed near it, and a small chest of drawers. Opening the top drawer, I found a handwritten leaflet inside. It said, "Hello. We, the Remedials, welcome you to our humble hotel. We trust you will have a pleasant, comfortable, and enlightening stay with us, however long it may last. If you find that you need anything, be sure and ask. That is why we're here, after all. May you have an illuminating stay with us. The Remedial Hotel." Something about the message seemed a bit odd, but at that point I was too dispirited to care. The only other thing that I found was a Gideon's Bible in the bottom drawer, its leather cover full of what appeared to be tiny teeth marks. Well, it had taken me my entire adult life, but I had finally hit rock bottom. Flopping down on the bed, I closed my eyes and waited for the dust to settle back on top of me. I didn't expect sleep, just a brief respite from the world and its awfulness. When I opened my eyes, I was sure only a few minutes had passed, but according to my watch, it was morning. I'd slept for something like 16 hours straight through. Rather shocked, I sat up and saw a man in the mirror opposite the bed, who looked like he'd been rolled in stale breadcrumbs. I dusted myself down, got off the bed, and headed for the door. After finding a bathroom secreted at the end of the dingy corridor, and attempting to wash myself with a postage stamp of soap on the edge of the bath, I went downstairs for breakfast. "In the basement," the same overly cheerful man said from behind his desk. And today it's tinned mushrooms. How about that? I headed for the basement without reply. It was a bit of a surprise to find that it was so crowded, not having seen or heard a soul since I arrived. But it was full of people, sat at single tables, hunched over bowls and plates beneath the harsh light. Looking at the long table, full of self-service breakfast, I decided to give the speciality of the house, the tinned mushrooms, a miss, instead opting for a couple of slices of dry toast. Finding an empty table, I sat down. I tried to take my mind off my problems by doing a bit of people watching. Without exception, every person looked intently at their plates, as if they wanted to sink into them and disappear from view. They looked as miserable as I felt. If possible, my spirits dove even deeper. The last thing I wanted was to be stuck around people like this. Finishing my toast, I went back to my room. "Good night, sir," the man on the reception chirped. "Don't let the bedbugs bite." I was just about to contradict him on the time when I opened my eyes and found myself in bed. The room was in darkness, except for the light coming under the gap in the door. Laying there, I tried to think about it. If it had all been a dream, then it was an extremely vivid one. I'd felt the toast softening in my mouth, seen the second hand on my watch whirring around, the basement full of people with downcast eyes, but... well, if it wasn't a dream, then it meant I'd blacked out, and I'd fallen. In the gallery? I couldn't remember. I also couldn't remember changing into my pyjamas. But there wasn't any doubt. I was lying there in a set of baggy clothes, so I must have got changed. To be doubly sure, I felt the material. The soft shirt, the buttons, my collar and tie. What on earth was happening? I swung my legs onto the floor. It felt like they landed a split second later than they should have done. Slipping my feet into my shoes, I stumbled towards the light switch, managing to trip before I get there and sprawling hands first against the wall. The damp cotton wool I had in the back of my shoes must have slipped, which made them too big. And kicking them off, I stretched up towards the light switch and clicked it on. As the room lit up, I felt a movement beneath my hand. It was as though the wall had turned into a blind and was spinning up out of my grasp. But then I saw that the reverse was true. I was sliding down from it, further and further from the light switch. Terrified, I looked down to see the enormous shoes I was standing between. My shoes, which were quickly covered with my clothes, falling from my body all around me. And then my tie plummeted past me, over me, like a large grey lasso, landing in a perfect circle on top of the huge mound of clothes, its tongue fluttering to the floor in slow motion. Following its descent past the mirror, I saw the full horror of the situation. I didn't have long to look at my rapidly diminishing naked body. As I watched, I sank, and my head was soon below the mirror's cracked frame. When I turned around, I was looking up at a dirty woolen blanket, its frilled edges apparently leading to the ceiling. I don't know what happened for a while. I shrieked. I shrank. I ran around naked on the carpet through the dust, eventually through the curtain of fringes so I was under the bed itself, running through a grey desert of dust balls the size of boulders. The black hessian of the bed's bottom just above my head like a lowered ceiling. I don't know how long it took. My watch was out there somewhere, no doubt lying on its side like a rusted car. But eventually, I became less hysterical, got the panicking down to a manageable level, and started, or tried, to think. I tried to judge what height I was now. 6 inches? Less than that. I'd never have gotten under the bed otherwise. 4 inches then? No. I decided 3 was about right. Then I remembered the dream. That was it. I was still in the dream. Or in a dream. An extremely vivid dream. Which meant that this wasn't really happening. I calmed down a bit more. All I had to do then was last the dream, the nightmare, whatever it was, out. It was only one night. I just had to play along with it. I walked through the piles of dust and assorted rubbish towards the fringed curtain overhanging the bed. Approaching the frills, I found that the floor must be slightly uneven as I had to bend to stop my head touching the hessian. Grabbing a gnarled thread in each hand, I parted the fringes and looked out into the room. At the other end of it, several miles away, a single eye was staring at me under the door. Startled, I fell backwards, letting go of the fringes, expecting to knock my head on the bed ceiling. But instead, I toppled over, landing among the dust balls. Without giving myself time to think, I ran through the dust to the other side of the bed. I was nearly there, the other set of fringes in reach, when something grey with a shell scampered between the fringes towards me. At first, I thought it hadn't seen me, as it darted around the dust balls, stray hairs and sweet wrappers. But then it did see me, and it was heading straight for me, like an armour-plated car. A woodlouse? My mind screamed out. I was going to be eaten alive by a woodlouse? I began to sprint back the way I came, but the woodlouse was gaining on me. I pulled up quickly. There. A long, blonde eyelash, laying there in the dust. In what felt like slow motion, I picked it up, hefting it in my tiny hand as if it were a baseball bat or a sword. I looked up to see the woodlouse almost on top of me. Well, I lashed out, struck it, the eyelash bending, springing out of my hand, but well, the shock of it was enough. The woodlouse stopped, turned, and scurried back the way it came, out from under the bed. Planting my hands on my knees, my face now barely an inch above the carpet, I looked at the tangle of things trapped in the fibres as I tried to get my breath back. I was not safe down there. I remembered the gap under the door and what I'd seen scurrying under it, not to mention what was under it now. The room was filthy too, and I doubted that the woodlouse was on its own. What else would be waiting for me? Weapons. I needed weapons. The situation, bizarre and terrifying as it was bringing something out in me. For the first time in my life, I had the will to survive. My reactions were quickening, my thoughts clarifying. I was down on my hands and knees, looking for suitable objects to defend myself with. The blonde eyelash had been okay, but it was too willowy. But there were other types of eyelash down there. Eyebrows too. The bed must have been in a different position at some point. That had probably been here for years. Using the little weight and strength that I had, I began to yank them free from the carpet, testing them. I found that ginger eyelashes and grey eyebrows were the best because they were the thickest. And soon I had a small arsenal of red and grey hairs piled up beside me, male and females. The ones coated in mascara were the thickest of them all, but also the heaviest. Putting them under my arm, I marched towards the fringes on the further side of the bed, ready for any attack. And it wasn't long in coming. I'd hardly taken my first step through the frills when the woodlouse came at me again. Dropping all of the lashes except for the thickest grey one, I waited until it was perhaps half an inch from me, and then I levered the hair beneath its body before wrenching it upwards. I watched in fascination as the insect was upended, stranded on its back with its legs scissor-kicking the air in front of me. Dragging myself away from this obscene spectacle, I began picking up my collection of weapons once more, when the air above me suddenly began to hum. I looked up to see a fly the size of my face coming straight at me. Again, I dropped my weapons, but this time in panic. And as I scrabbled around among the lashes, I could feel the warm air from the fly's wings ruffling my hair. I didn't even have time to aim. But once again, my newly awakened senses rescued me. The thickest red eyelash I had was almost completely smeared in mascara. I stood behind it and bent it back quickly before letting go of the end. The hair sprung forward like a bent branch, and almost immediately a cloud of dried mascara flew from the hair. My face was pelted with thick flakes, and around me the sound of angry buzzing was deafening. I crouched, waiting for the fly to pick me up or start chewing my head, but nothing happened. Slowly, I opened my eyes. The fly was nowhere to be seen. I decided then that I'd hung around long enough. The sooner I got up onto the bed, the better. Or at least up there I could hide under the blankets. Picking out the thickest of my remaining weapons, I clamped them between my teeth and started to climb the frills. The climb wasn't half as bad as I'd imagined. I was grateful that the bed was so much lower than most, and I made quick progress. At one point, I had to slow down a bit to circumnavigate a large dried-up bogey stuck to one of the tassels, but that was all. Reaching the summit, I pulled myself up the last frill with renewed energy, only to find the fly at the top, waiting for me. With one hand still clenched around the frill, I removed my weapons from my mouth as the fly hurtled towards me in a rush of legs and wings. Again, I waited until it was almost upon me, before swinging both lashes together at it as hard as I could. I was still yelling with the effort when I saw the body slice in two, the top half spinning into the air and falling barely a centimetre in front of me. The journey to the centre of the bed was much quicker than I thought it would be. And looking back at the fly, something occurred to me. Even though it was in two pieces, the fly seemed much smaller than before. Smaller than I would have expected. In fact, looking at the whole room, everything seemed smaller. Or I'd gotten bigger again. Yes, that was why the climb up the bed hadn't taken so long. It also explained why I hadn't knocked my head when I fell back earlier. My size was being governed by my reactions to my surroundings. When I was scared, I shrank. When I felt more confident, I grew. The whole thing had the logic of a dream. Oh, of course, I was still dreaming. Because everything was so real, I'd forgotten that. I just had to hang on in there. It couldn't last forever. But when I dreamt a long, thin spiderweb descending from the ceiling, with a big, fat, hungry spider dangling from the end of it, such rationality went out of the window. Once more, I could feel myself shrinking. Finding my weapons over by the fly, I grabbed one in each hand and turned just as the spider landed on the bed, still attached to its thread. I looked at the spider. It began to move towards me. I thought of running away, but instead, I charged. With a red eyelash curved in my left hand like a scimitar and the grey eyebrow in my right like a bayonet, I hurtled across the blanket towards it, faster than I'd ever run in my life, both blades aimed straight at its nasty little eyes. And as I ran, I could feel myself getting bigger, heavier. My tread was now indenting the blanket. And all of a sudden I felt a foot tall. But before I had a chance to attack the spider, it was climbing its thread once more, scared by my sudden size. By the time it was a few inches from the ceiling, I found I was tall enough to look over the side of the bed without having to move. And the eye was still there, watching from under the door. I was about the size of a toddler now, but I couldn't see how I could get any bigger. Well, following the logic of the dream, I knew that I couldn't stay there forever. I had to open the door and face whatever was on the other side. Despite everything I'd just been through, I hesitated. The eye was grotesque enough, but... Well, it was what it represented, both here and at the gallery. I looked up at the ceiling to the spider, an insignificant little speck now, of no real danger. And I thought. It took me a while, but I got there in the end. I let out a small yelp of delight, evidently frightening the spider, which began to swing from side to side. The implications of my logic made it no easier to go to the door, however. And as my doubts arose, I could feel myself beginning to shrink again. I knew I had to get myself off that bed before I vanished entirely. I had to get out of the hotel and back to that gallery. And the thought of the gallery triggered an idea, which in turn triggered a memory. Once, in another hotel, I bumped into a much better salesman than me. He told me how he used to go from house to house with a large vacuum cleaner in his car and a packet of photographs. The spiel he used was always the same. He'd informed the householder that even the cleanest bed in the world was home to hundreds of thousands of tiny bedbugs. Revolting little things they were, he said, and that the only way to get rid of them properly was with his special vacuum cleaner. When the householder, usually sceptical, began to he'd show them the photographs. The pictures were of bedbugs, magnified to such a size that they filled the whole of an 8x10 in glorious colour. Hundreds of thousands in your bed, he would remind them. And more often than not, the householder would ask him to wheel in his special vacuum cleaner and demonstrate in the bedroom. And suddenly I knew that if I didn't get off this bed soon, I was going to shrink. Maybe shrink to such a degree that I would be able to see those bugs face to face. Hundreds of thousands of them. "Don't let the bedbugs back," the receptionist had said. That bed was like a jungle, full of unseen menace, ready to devour me. Well, that did the trick. I leapt, landing in the oversized pile of clothes. Not wanting to meet whatever was on the other side of the door naked, I pulled the clothes around me roughly. Taking a very deep breath, I slowly opened the door. The receptionist was standing there, grinning at me, his fist raised to knock.
"Ah, you're awake. Well, it's a wonderful morning, sir. I trust you had a good night. I hope you're ready for breakfast. It's tinned mushrooms today."
I've never tasted boiled slugs before, but after chewing one for the best part of a minute, I rather imagine that they taste like tinned mushrooms. "These mushrooms," I said, pointing at the chewed up mess with my fork. "They're not funny mushrooms, are they? If you get my meaning? I didn't have any last time and forgot about it." I pushed the mushrooms to one side and moved on to the toast instead. The receptionist smiled.
"Oh, no, sir. Definitely not. No, everything you experienced happened. And you did very well. You managed to do what a lot of the others don't."
I stopped crunching. The ones I saw at breakfast before, you mean? He nodded. Limbo people. They live that existence day in, day out. Or similar. As you have done, in a way. But you use the things around you to change things. They haven't figured that out yet. So they stay as they are. But they will. Hopefully. One day. Over the years, I've often wondered how many of them managed it. As I finished breakfast, I asked questions. Lots of questions. About the gallery. The strange dimensions of the hotel. The pipe coming through the ceiling. The eyes in the picture. The eye under my door. The people in the gallery. The people in the hotel and the seeming lack of staff. The tinned mushrooms. I even considered asking about the tiny bite marks on the Gideon's Bible, but then I decided I didn't really want to know. And then I asked, why me? The receptionist just smiled. Strange things happen sometimes. You found us. Most don't. And you discovered that you wanted to live. Really live. And now you can. Go. Look life in the eyes. After shaking his hand, I went back up to room 127, passing door after closed door. And I wondered what was going on behind each one. I retrieved my luggage. My room wasn't as big or as scary or as dismal as I remembered. It was just a room. Once outside the hotel, it vanished. I turned around to find a patch of waste ground next to an abandoned subway station. Picking up my suitcase, I headed for the gallery. But instead of stumbling into it, I strode this time. The picture was still there. But it had changed. The eyes were just where they should be, above and either side of the nose, staring straight ahead, out into the room. I stared straight back at them, holding their gaze. As I left the gallery, I realised I'd forgotten to look at the very thing that I'd meant to check. The picture's title. But I could guess what it was. The picture had changed in other ways too, and that had been something of a distraction. The man in the picture now had a swollen nose, as if he'd fallen face first onto a hard surface. Perhaps even more surprisingly, he now had a huge grin on his face. Well, I raised an eyebrow at that. We the Remedials was written by John Travis and performed by Dion Winton Pollock. You can find this story in Gaseous Clay and Other Ambivalent Tales, published by Ibonvale Press. Copyright 2005. Links to the author, the publishers, and the books can be found in the show notes, along with attributions for the music and sound effects that I've used. We the Remedials was a Fine Toothed Comb production.